Welcome back to the Vacation Bible School Podcast. My name is Jason Kirk. I'm your youth pastor or whatever. Joined, as always, by Emily Kirk, the podcast host with no title whatsoever.
None.
We are here today on our podcast in which we sort of wonder how in the world anyone ever could think the Bible is boring. We're here to discuss Exodus. We have finally made it out of one out of 66 or so, depending on your canon books. Emily, how do you feel about the book of Exodus in terms of before we actually reread it?
That Moses was very, very good and chosen.
Yes, Moses was important. There were many movies about him.
Right.
Definitely lots of footage, Moses content out there.
I think the only one I ever actually watched was The Prince of Egypt.
Mm-hmm. Which we did rewatch, and I think we're going to try and talk about at the end of this episode. So the book of Exodus, it might be the most pivotal book in the Hebrew Bible, arguably the most important. I think it might be the only book in the Hebrew Bible that you could actually inform yourself pretty well of the entire religion based on just this book. Genesis is obviously very critical, but you could pick up pretty quickly the Israelites are chosen, and Exodus is going to establish an origin story for the actual nation of Israel. It's going to establish God's rapid leveling up as a power, as a character, and it's going to give us some rules going forward. We haven't really had any rules yet.
Time to follow the rules.
The anarchy zone of Genesis is over. We're going to literally lay down the law, and the law will crumble because we are outraged about the dancing and the golden cat. We're getting ahead of ourselves. So the basic questions on Exodus: when was this written? The storyline is going to be around the 1200s BC based on some reasons we'll talk about later. It had to have been edited basically by the 400s BC, so pretty much anywhere in there. Our Hebrew scholar friend Brad Haggard, his opinion is it's right around the 7th century, right around the year 800, and he has explanations for this based on the Book of Deuteronomy and Assyrian treaties. So sure, how does that sound? Around 800, that sound fine to you?
Yeah, we'll call it 800.
Who is the author? Once again, Moses is the traditional author, but the actual answer is at least three very different unknown people from unknown times, along with a basically unknown editor group project.
Those always go well.
So Moses' starting point we see in this story. We're going to see he's a character with maybe the biggest, fullest arc of anyone in the Bible outside of God himself. For one thing, there's a lot of Moses. He's part of four straight books, and we see him from baby all the way to death. You know, we've seen Jacob and Joseph grow up and change, but with Moses, it's a whole other level. He goes from nothing to a big something and back to nothing, and that's really before his main story even starts. And we get to see him, at least in the first half of Exodus, as a man with challenges, with struggles, with flaws that he himself is aware of.
We see Moses go through this change where he's not an adult yet. He's still this young guy. He hasn't become the Moses that we know and love from the Bible. And part of that is you kind of look at him as this person that does not have it all together. And part of that, I think, is that he is just looking at whatever authority figure is in front of him and trying to please that person. So at some points it's the Pharaoh. At some points it's now God.
And it's interesting because, as we'll see, he's sort of raised as an authority figure. He's raised as royalty, raised as a noble, even though at some point deep down he knows that was not his original lineage heritage. So with Moses, there's a lot of wrestling with identity going on.
I think that sort of distracts him from thinking too hard about what's in front of him.
And it makes for a more interesting story. Like, not only is that the reason the story can possibly happen, it also just simply makes for a better character and a more sympathetic character, I think, because we have a private school kid who is suddenly tasked with the hardest task any human has ever had based on the list of humanity recorded in the Bible. It's a lot to ask of a young guy.
Yeah.
And we mean young in Bible terms, because by the time the story really, really gets rolling, he is 80 years old. As always on this show, we're going to have a little bit of fun. We're going to learn a little bit of stuff, and we intend to approach this material with a large amount of respect. A lot of people take all this stuff very seriously, and that's cool. A lot of people take it not seriously at all, and I don't really have a problem with that either. So let's get right to it. The sons of Jacob, founding fathers of the 12 tribes of Israel, have moved to Egypt to live with Joseph, one of their youngest members, the former slave who became the vice president of Egypt. The nation of of Israel at this point is still only about 70 people. What sets our story here into motion is relatively nice Pharaoh dies, the Pharaoh who hired Joseph. Here comes Pharaoh 2, who, quote, does not know Joseph. Feels ominous. Even the relatively nice Pharaoh in this story, the predecessor, the one who hired Joseph, the Israelites still had to get permission from him to come and go, and they still had a designated area. And Jacob and them, they still had to have a reason for being given this land. So now here comes a Pharaoh who has that same level of power, has that same level of distrust toward outsiders, but he doesn't even know Joseph. He doesn't think he has an obligation to the family of the magic boy who led Egypt through famine. This Pharaoh says of the Israelites, who just had, it said, only 70 people, quote, they are more numerous and more powerful than we are. The Israelites are more powerful than the Egyptians, according to the Pharaoh himself. So, like, how did this happen? Like, how is the whole entire nation scared of what was just paragraphs earlier, just 70 people?
I mean, the Israelites, now all they had to do in their free time was reproduce. They didn't have anything better to do.
So, I mean, we know that God commanded Adam and then Noah and then Abraham and then everyone after Abraham to be fertile, to multiply. Perhaps they have taken that to the extreme. They do live in the fertile Egyptian territory of Goshen.
Yeah, the Egyptians spent a lot of time doing their hair and makeup, so they didn't have as much time to reproduce.
Yes, based on films, we know that, you make a pyramid, you do not have time to have 1,000 children like an Israelite does. Possible to move from one pharaoh to the next involved a big time jump that isn't resolved, that, you know, no one says anything about it for like 11 chapters. That would be weird. There's no way that's the answer. It's possible 70 Israelites. It's possible there were only 69 Egyptians, so they're outnumbered. There's exactly 69 Egyptians. So yeah, we find out 11 chapters later the answer was the time jump that just no one mentioned. The Israelites have been in Egypt for 400 years.
They've had time.
They've had time to outpopulate the Egyptians. This is also really stretching the ages of these pharaohs, but hey, we're putting out numerical fires left and right.
It's biblical times. Time is different.
So Joseph came to Egypt as a slave, brought the Israelites to Egypt as a not exactly free people. Pharaoh too, paranoid, clamps down and uses enslaved labor to build cities. Remember from the end of episode 4, we learned cities are bad. Also, one of these cities is named Ramesses. We'll come back to that. But cracking down on the Israelites only makes them even more fertile. Exodus 1:14, the Egyptians were ruthless about making the Israelites make bricks. Remember, the Tower of Babel used mortar instead of mud. Remember, that's an affront to nature. That's technology. That's unnatural. That's bad. The Israelites are being forced to build not only yucky cities, they're being forced to use yucky technology to do it. So right here, we come to our first sort of outside the text historical question. Was Israel ever in Egypt as one humongous nation? This is a big shrug. We know in our last episode, we talked about the Hyksos, a Semitic people that was in Egypt at around this general time frame. But the fact is, they ruled part of Egypt. In fact, it's right around where Goshen was, rather than being enslaved by the Egyptians the entire time they were there. There's really no evidence otherwise that a huge group of Semitic people spent a long, long time in Egypt enslaved. There were certainly cultural exchanges. You know, there were like Joseph-like advisors in Egypt. We know pharaohs taxed Semitic immigrants, conquests between these two regions, and it's highly possible some people were enslaved. There's really no evidence for anything of this scale. But I did, and I don't know, Emily, if you had anything like this, I kind of doubt it. I had a Bible archaeology book when I was a kid. I'm sure a lot of it was legit. I'm sure a lot of it was like, this is probably where this temple was. But the stuff I remember most was the stuff that even as a kid, I was like, I don't know about this one, where it's like, here's a rock in Turkey that might be Noah's Ark.
No, that was the stuff that like youth group people would try to debate, but we couldn't afford books. I don't really remember having many books as a kid until I got into like R.L. Stein in middle school.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's a better choice. That's better for your brain than something that, so this Bible archaeology book, there was something about like NASA found heat signatures of so many people crossing Sinai that it had to be the residual warmth of the Israelites from 3,000 years earlier. And we can see it from space. And I remember as a kid, like, so you're telling me if you go stand in this desert, it's hotter right there because of how many Israelites walked across it.
Not because it's the desert.
Well, that too. But yeah, long story short, we have no idea to what degree the following story is entirely accurate, but there are facets of this story that are surely accurate. For one thing, there's a pharaoh. We know there were pharaohs in Egypt. There's an Egypt. They're still in Egypt, right? We're really making progress in terms of historical accuracy
over
Genesis.
See? It's all all true.
Stamp it, every single word. This is, in a sense, an origin story of Israel. Jacob became Israel, and the founding of the Israelite nation was 70 people. But Israel as a nation, as we think of it as a nation, it comes to be in Egypt. And it's not until the flight from Egypt that it's really established as a full thing. And there's a question, and a lot of people have thrown this around as sort of an argument for historical veracity, that why would you invent an origin story of your nation that is about being enslaved? Why would you say that is where we come from? And you know, it's quite possible this is a reference to Babylon. We talked about that at the end of the last episode. It's quite possible these are actual valid, legit memories that come from bondage, captivity, enslavement, whether it's in Egypt or it's in Canaan at the hands of Egypt, because we know Egypt at times within the many centuries that surround the point of this story did in fact conquer Palestine. And it's possible that the Exodus is sort of a metaphor for Egypt leaving Canaan. So the long story short is, let's just proceed as if it happened.
Yeah.
So Pharaoh is panicking because there's all these extremely fertile people in his city. So Pharaoh, his solution is to tell the Egyptian midwives to start killing Israelite newborn boys. Christians will, of course, later note this as a King Herod-Jesus connection. But the Pharaoh is foiled. One of the most beautiful verses in the Bible. The vigorous Hebrew women give birth before the midwife comes to them.
That verse stood out to me so much. One, because it's like, okay, here we are. The women are tricksters again. But like, the women have any control over that whatsoever to give birth before the midwives get there.
I think this one is just a sheer physical strength.
Yeah, they just really just push it right out.
They just have the will.
Yeah, the will.
The effort, just firing these lads out. So Pharaoh, his solution to counter this is to tell everyone to just start throwing all the Israelite boys in the Nile River. So the man and woman from the Israelite tribe of Levi have a baby boy. Levi, of course, is one of those 12 sons of Jacob. Levi was brother number 3, one of the two who missed out on the capital B blessing because of the dick sleeve murders.
Here we go again.
Jacob's deathbed prophecy for Levi is that his tribe would be violent. Makes sense, but they'll become something else. This boy's mom follows the rule. She puts the boy in the Nile, but snuck into the water via a basket, a word that can also mean ark. She seals the basket with pitch, just like Noah's ark, and she floats it toward the Pharaoh's daughter, while the boy's sister keeps an eye out. So once again, just like Eve, like Rebecca, like our girl Tamar, a woman has done some quiet trickery to usurp a man's big, dumb proclamation and keep hope alive. Pharaoh's daughter finds the baby, and then the baby's sister, who'd been keeping an eye on things, says, "Looks like you got yourself a Hebrew baby. I better go find a Hebrew nanny for you." So this baby boy's sister goes and gets the baby boy's mother. Pharaoh's daughter is now paying this lower class family to nanny their own kid. This is the plot of Parasite. Also, this child is important. Here's where we confirm that Pharaoh's daughter names his kid Moses, which might be a reference to Ramesses, a reference in Egyptian to water, maybe a word the Hebrews later infer means he who draws out, as in drawn out of the Nile's water, as in will draw the Israelites out of Egypt, as in will draw the Israelites out of the Red Sea's water. It's a name that has Egyptian and Israelite connotations. Also, according to the Extended Universe ancient Jewish commentary, Pharaoh's daughter is one of very few people who gets to enter heaven without dying, like Enoch in Genesis. So Moses is raised Egyptian as a prince of Egypt, like the DreamWorks film, but one day sees an Egyptian beating an Israelite. Moses kills the Egyptian and hides the body in the sand. This is like our only real clue in the Bible that Moses has to grapple with being in between these two identities, the extreme of privilege and the extreme lack of privilege, and he chooses to side with his heritage rather than his privilege. So Moses does crime, tries to hide it, but everybody knows. Pharaoh finds out Moses has 5 wanted stars.
Overall, so far what we've learned is Moses may not be the brightest person.
So to this point, he has done what, as far as we know, is a noble deed. He's defended someone, but he did a very terrible job of covering it up.
Right, but is the immediate reaction to kill rather than to maybe go about it another way?
Well, because he was a prince of Egypt, he probably could have just said, hey, knock it off.
Right, there's probably a law he could have done there.
Moses is a brute force kind of guy at this point. Let's see if that keeps up. Moses just takes off off running. And he runs really far. He's in the middle of Egypt around the Nile. He starts running east. He goes all the way to water. And then he keeps going. He's going to like the middle of Sinai, that thing that connects Asia and Africa. Out there, he finds the Midianites, the descendants of Abraham, who we last saw buying Joseph from a well. They live near Mount Sinai. It's called by a few different names, and it might be some other mountain, and we don't know if we know where it is, but let's call it all Mount Sinai. So this family that Moses flees to, they're led by a Midianite priest named Jethro. Jethro has 7 daughters. Moses shows up and defends them against some sheep rustlers. They refer to Moses as the Egyptian. Yet another clue that who he is on the outside does not yet match who he is on the inside. So blah, blah, blah. Jethro marries his daughter Zipporah to Moses and they have a kid. Moses' wife, she's later referred to as a Cushite, which can mean Nubian. Culturally, historically, we can usually think of their territory as the people south of Egypt. Jewish tradition has often been that she was black. In one of the most famous paintings of her, and not just of her in the background of some scene, she's explicitly Ethiopian. Also, makeup company, how do you say it?
Sephora.
Sephora, okay, yes. Named after her. So that is a lasting cultural impact. Is that good makeup?
Well, they have their own brand, but they sell a lot of high-end brands.
Okay, so. Spectacular. So this very brief desert courtship between Moses and Zipporah is a spin on the Isaac, Jacob, etc. aquatic girl in middle of desert trope that we saw a few times in Genesis. And there's always story stuff to glean from it. Like in Isaac's, the lady did all the work, and she would later do all the work of getting the birthright from Isaac to her favored son. In Jacob's, it was all about welcoming struggle, about agreeing to grit through 14 years of con man labor because nobody outstubborns Jacob. In Moses, it's about liberating distant relatives. Remember, the Midianites, just like Moses, come from Abraham. Spoiler alert, more distant relatives will be liberated. Also, here's a good point to note how much water is connected to Moses. The name Moses has aquatic connotations in 2 languages. He was cast into water, reborn from it. He's married by it. Later on, he'll learn water magic. His final victory comes from water. He worships the God who masters the chaos water of Genesis. And Moses has a magic water stick that he uses way too often. Very appropriate hero for a bunch of desert nomads. Waterman.
So this isn't really on topic necessarily, but do you think that maybe people weren't named back then, and later on when people were writing the Bible that they gave everyone names? Because that's why they're so fitting.
Yeah, they are a little on the nose.
Yeah.
Literally everyone.
Right.
Like back to Adam.
Well, and the names that you're given overall, there's so much talk about some of these names that it makes it feel like they're trying to make a point of them rather than just naming them.
Oh, yes, very much. Like there's no one just named like Steve.
Right.
That it's like...
Well, there is a Dan.
There is a Dan, but pretty much everyone, you could guess who they are based on just their name. Support for VBS happens in a couple different ways.
You can throw us a few bucks at supportvbs.com, however many you'd like. By the time you visit that link, there might be bonuses for donors and or merch. But all Canon Bible Book episodes will always be free either way.
Also, for no bucks at all, you can follow us at VBS Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. Subscribe to our newsletter at jasonkirk.substack.com and leave us a review on your podcast app of choice. Jethro, of course, I'm going to assume, I haven't looked up the name Jethro. I'm going to assume it means very, very wise man.
Country boy.
Desert who is keeping the entire fire alive. So this is probably a good point is to get to the question of, was Moses real? Well, nobody knows, again. But the idea, similar to the enslavement story, that the Israelites wouldn't have chosen to create Moses as a founding father, because he's not only a man of Egyptian upbringing, semi-Egyptian name, with a Midianite wife, he's uncircumcised. This is the guy you're going to pick as your liberator, as your greatest prophet, as your lawbringer, if you're just making the story up. So there probably are elements of the Moses story that are at least references to real things. Moses is quite possibly an amalgamation of a bunch of different Middle East stories and legends, including the story of a rogue Egyptian priest who leads a leper army of lepers with the Hyksos against against a pharaoh. Leper army. However, the leper army story didn't emerge until historian Josephus, who lived after Jesus, so it's quite possible the Egyptians heard the story of Moses and made up a counter myth where the proto-Israelites were all lepers. This is, of course, the kind of thing the Israelites did to rival tribes all the time in Genesis, just make up an unflattering story about their intro.
Well, we're going to learn a little bit about power of leprosy, too, so we'll talk about that soon.
There's more. Hey, folks, if you like leprosy content, also, Moses' origin story, the secret baby floated down a river in a pitch-sealed basket raised by a powerful family. That's also the birth myth of Sargon of Akkad, a real person from 2000s BC, one of the world's first emperors. And Moses having the same origin as Sargon, this lends credence to much of the Torah being at least edited in Babylon, because Sargon, Akkad, Akkadians, sort of the proto-Babylonians. Sargon is considered one of the influences for Genesis's, quote, mighty ancient Babylonian warrior character. Fifth straight episode, he makes the cut. It's Nimrod. That's right. Also, there's some kind of alt-right thing having to do with Sargon, so we should move on. Pharaoh, too, dies. The Israelites are still enslaved, crying out about it, catching... Who hears about it?
God.
Who's that?
We haven't talked about him for a little while.
We haven't talked about God for like 20-something chapters, because he hasn't done anything. He nearly beats Jacob at wrestling, and that might not have even been God. It might have just been an embarrassed Esau in disguise. And then all God did the rest of Genesis was like float around Joseph's head and maybe decode dreams, or maybe he didn't. Maybe Joseph was just making all that up.
Well, but either way, remember, God never appeared to Joseph. It was only he would help him interpret dreams.
Yeah, there was no record of like, and then God told Joseph what the cake meant. Joseph is telling us all that. But regardless, the big guy is back. And what an entrance for the master of the universe. Here comes God. It's a bush that's on fire in the middle of nowhere.
But the bush isn't actually burning either, so that's kind of
very cool.
Magic fire.
It's a sparkler in the middle of nowhere. This is what is left of the Chaos Eater, the World Maker, the Sodom Bomber. The ultimate power of the universe is a sparkler on a hill that no one knew about. Something weird is happening here. So this bush says to Moses, hey buddy, over here, down here, it's God, it's creator of the universe, down here in these sticks. I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Take your shoes off because you're standing on holy ground. This is interesting because Abraham never had to do this. Adam, Jacob, everyone who's ever gotten close to God in a humanish body never had to do this. Moses is closer to the essence, the core, the holy power of God than anyone ever has been.
Except for Jacob wrestling.
But Jacob got to wear his shoes. Probably.
Maybe shoes weren't around yet.
Jacob's wearing his wrestling cleats.
I don't think shoes were invented yet then. So now shoes are around.
So now the shoe technology has been unlocked. Maybe, I guess that's what it is. Okay. Yeah,
because it's been a while.
So the big guy. God says, Moses, I'm going to free Israel. Israel's going to kill all the Canaanites and a whole bunch of other ites. And you're going to help. You're going to go tell Pharaoh to let him go. And Moses is like, okay, so I'm just here hanging out with my in-laws, who are very cool, Jethro's family, my wife, Zipporah, we're shepherds. I used to be a prince of Egypt. Now I'm just a nobody. It's pretty great out here. We just sit on this hill. We raise our sheep. And now
I'm talking to a bush,
and it's telling me I got to go back and I got to fight Pharaoh to release his enslaved populace. Moses even says like, hey, I'm just some guy who's bad at crime and you're a bush. What are we talking about here? And God's like, yeah, it's going to rule. So you go do it and then we'll meet back up here and you can tell me I'm awesome. This is a lot to take in.
Yeah.
Like reading this afresh for the first time in a long time, I was sympathizing a lot with Moses. Yeah, I get it. God wants to do this. I also get that Moses wasn't raised an Israelite. Moses wasn't raised to worship this God. Moses might have never heard the stories of this God, except for, you know, if he's walking around town and he hears the Israelites talking and maybe some of them are passing along ancient stories of their own. But Moses might know nothing about this bush that is talking to them. So Moses says, all right, let's say I go down, I tell the Israelites, you sent me to save them. They're going to say, oh yeah, okay, our God, you met our God. Moses says, give me a password. How can I convince them that I talked talk to you. And then God, for the first time, uses the big name. I am who I am is how it usually gets interpreted. It's a spin on the YHWH Jehovah name, the name we really don't know how to pronounce, that's often pronounced Yahweh. No one really knows exactly how it's pronounced. This is God's first ever usage of his own most sacred name. Moses is getting blasts of holiness. He's got to take off his shoes and he's hearing God say the most powerful word in the universe. And Moses is just some shepherd on a hill.
Well, and at this point too, because Moses was raised by Egyptians, he's probably, if he's aware at all, it's only because this is a powerful name or something. It's not because he's grown up with this religion.
Yeah, there's like some inherent convincing power in this.
Right.
Moses is raised to believe in, you know, dozens of gods. And this guy's saying like, no, I'm the big deal.
I'm the one.
And this God does it in such a convincing way that Moses is like, you know,
oh,
let's go back to the end of Genesis. Moses literally finds God by leaving the bustling civilization and going to the middle of nowhere. God is the God of everywhere, which means God is the God of the middle of nowhere. So God says, here's what we're going to do, Moses, my man, my ace Moses, we're going to go hammer Egypt with wonders. He uses the word wonders, which sort of, if you don't know how the story goes, you read wonders and you're like, oh, cool.
Oh, what's that mean?
Oh, he's going to
it's going to be awesome.
Yeah, he's going to put on a very cool spectacle for Egypt. He's going to do like an awesome fireworks display.
Well, he kind of does.
Yeah. And then Pharaoh's going to agree, and then they're going to liberate the Israelites.
It is weird because he literally talks about how he's going to convince them so hard that they're just going to give him riches,
yeah,
which is kind of bizarre.
I think this goes beyond even the promise to Abraham. God is constantly promising Abraham, you're going to have a lot of kids, you're going to have a lot of kids, you're going to have a lot of kids.
No, apparently they've had a lot of kids because half a million of them.
So we can confirm God did deliver on that promise because there are so many kids that are about to break Egypt.
They're leaving heat signatures.
There's so many kids you can see them from space.
Yeah.
So promise kept. But here, this is so specific that this is one of God's first prophecies, and the specific details are interesting to follow. You're going to give your women silver and gold, for instance. So God says, all right, let's do this. Moses, take your staff. You're a shepherd. You got a stick in your hand. You got a staff. Throw that thing on the ground. Moses does it. It turns into a snake.
Which we learned in Genesis, serpents are bad, so it's interesting that it turns into a snake.
Snakes in the Bible, they're complicated. They have a lot of different roles.
Yes.
And this is one where a snake that is a being made by God for a reason. So God says, Moses, handle that snake. So Moses becomes the world's first snake handler. Shout out to our Pentecostal listeners. God's like, behold, a magic trick. Egyptians loved Joseph's magic tricks. I'm sure this was cool and all, but like imagine Moses when he's like, shoot, you want me to go defeat one of the strongest empires on earth with a snake?
A stick snake.
So either way, God's like, fine. I got two more magic tricks for you, all right? You're going to put your hand in your coat and you're going to pull it out and you're going to have leprosy.
And this is how he gets a leper army.
This is probably where they whoever made that story took the detail like, oh yeah, well Moses was...
He was in control of the lepers.
Leper. So, yeah. So then Moses puts his hand back in his coat and the leprosy is gone. His hand is normal again. I want to note right here that this story thread goes nowhere. Moses does not use leprosy in the rest of the story.
But what a wonder.
It's like, I think this is just God is pranking Moses. God is like, buddy, you are asking a lot of questions. I'm going to need you to work with me. If you don't knock it off, you're going to keep your leper arm. So can we just move along here? The other trick is God convinces Moses that he'll be able to pour Nile water on the ground and have it turn into blood. Moses, being a real Abraham about everything, is still whining. He's saying, I'm bad at talking.
Yeah. See, he's admitting here that he is maybe not the smartest.
Yeah. I mean, I should be more fair. Moses is admitting his flaws, admitting his faults. He wants to do it. He was raised Egyptian. He identifies with the Israelites. That's why he's here to begin with. He wants to do it, but he knows he has his shortcomings. God's getting a little frustrated and he says, fine, your big brother Aaron can be the pen. You can be the teller. I did that, right? Like one talks and one's the magician. Pen is the talker, right?
I don't know.
Okay. Also, your wanted level is down to zero because the cops are dead. So you can go back to Egypt now.
Yay.
So this bush, there is now a Greek Orthodox monastery at the mountain that we usually think of as Mount Sinai, and it claims to still have the burning bush. It is no longer on fire, though.
Does it have burn marks?
I guess we could go take a look.
It probably doesn't because it didn't burn.
Exodus 4:21, God says, okay, you're going to go, you're going to get in front of Pharaoh, and you're going to do all the magic tricks, but I'm going to harden his heart. I'm going to keep making him stubborn so he won't let the Israelites go. God just said in chapter 3, he's going to hammer Egypt with all these wonders until they let the Israelites go. He's going to do that even if Pharaoh wants to yield before then.
And this is why I think Moses is not very bright, because the story continues even though God tells him, but I'm going to harden Pharaoh's heart, so he's not going to do it.
I think the Moses that we see toward the end of Exodus would hear this and say, hang on, would challenge God.
Right, like, he gets smarter.
Yes, there are lots of points later in the Torah where Moses challenges God, and God says, you know, that's a pretty good point. Let's do your idea. 4:22, God says, after we've done these wonders, you're going to tell Pharaoh, Israel is God's firstborn son, and since you didn't let Israel go, I'm going to kill your firstborn son. God has now laid out the entire plan. God's going to do a violent spectacle. God's going to make Pharaoh refuse to surrender. Then God's going to repeat the cycle, and then God is going to finally kill Pharaoh's son. God knows right here, Exodus 4:22, that he is going to slaughter Egyptians and kill children.
Which we started out in Exodus with the Egyptians killing all of the Hebrew boys, and now God's flipped it around. Now he's going to kill all the Egyptian firstborn. So, I don't know, an eye for an eye here?
Yeah, hey, that's coming later this book. In a sense, it's karma, it's revenge, it's retribution, it's visiting a sin upon a subsequent generation, which is, since there is no hell at this point in the Bible, that is how you punish. There is no hell in the Bible, by the way. That's my hot take. That's my hottest take of all. There's hell.
He can't wait for that part.
Hell's fake. So, like, since there is no, like, afterlife retribution, the concept of visiting punishment upon your children and your grandchildren is sort of the alternative here. Within that framework, punishing firstborns for what their parents did to somebody else's firstborns makes sense, even though we look at that like, wow, that is massive collateral damage. That is unfair.
Well, and also remember, up to this point, always the firstborn is screwed.
Yes.
This is just continuing that trend.
So right here, this is God's plan. Why did he pick Moses?
Because he was there.
Remember, no Israelites have been outside Egypt for hundreds of years. The entire nation went to Egypt. Joseph had to argue to be let out. So what chance did the rest of these folks have to leave Egypt? As far as we know, none of them did. We also learn later in this book that it is impossible for Israelites to worship God, aka smoke meat every day, while in Egypt. Remember how desperate God had been to impress Abraham after Abraham and God had, according to the expanded universe, fled polytheist Babylon together. God needs a steady supply of worship. He needed Abraham. He needed Jacob. He was not getting a lot of worship from Joseph, and there was not a ton of shrines being built that we know of on the way down and in Egypt. It is quite possible nobody has worshiped God for 400 years.
Right. There's a reason that they skipped 400 years in the Bible.
So we saw the condition God was in when he found Abraham. That was not master of the universe, flood monster God that met Abraham. That was, hey man, let's go in on this together. You burn a lot of stuff for me, I'll burn a city for you. It's called Sodom, right? That was deal maker God who needed people. Now you take that God, you build him up a little bit because he's got 70 people, but then you take away the 70 people. So now God, somehow on the way down from Canaan to Egypt, God sort of got discarded. God fell off to the side. Maybe they went and built a shrine on Mount Sinai on the way down to Egypt. It's not mentioned in the Bible that they did this. And maybe they forgot to take God with them. It doesn't say that, but it comes really, really close.
At this point, it's like God finds these people and he's putting all his eggs in one basket. He doesn't have tribes of people overall. It's usually one person that he's focused on who's then going on to spread his word. So up to this point, God is not yet a religion necessarily. We're still in that building process. And normally when we look at the Bible, we say, oh yeah, this is a full-on religion. But up to this point where it's taking place in the Bible, that religion has not really had a stronghold yet.
It's not codified. We're still in the point in this religion where there's this guy named God.
Right.
That's basically the whole religion, is he said, don't kill humans. And he said, I like it when you do sacrifices to me. That is the extent of the religion. And we can go back and we can read in all the stuff that happens in later books, and we can say God is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Or we can just look at what has literally happened, which is the master of the universe and a host of angels who were around him at the time, created Earth, had a rocky relationship with people. this god tried to destroy all the people and then found these people are worshiping lots of other beings. We know these angels were with him at the beginning, so maybe those are all the other gods. I don't know. Either way, we know God was not monopolizing worship, so he latched onto Abraham, and that worked for a little while until these folks got stuck in polytheist Egypt, and God is stuck on Mount Sinai. So Moses was on the run with mysterious priest Jethro, the old guy in the wilderness, descendant of Abraham, who maybe knows some forgotten mystical stuff, maybe semi-forgotten gods like Jehovah. So maybe Jethro is telling Moses, hey, have I ever told you the stories of the God of the Israelites, the people you came from? And maybe while he's there, they're walking by Mount Sinai, God is stuck in this bush, and God's finally catching a whiff of his people. God sees Moses there, and God just lights up, right? Literally. Because, oh my gosh, they're back. They're here. One of them, at least. So my theory is that Jethro was just sitting out there for decades and decades, the last free ember of faith in main character God, surrounding by all these overlapping polytheisms. And like maybe Jethro dabbled in all of them because he's not like mentioned as exclusively a worshiper of God. But he always wondered about the little fire god on Sinai who claimed to have created the universe but had been discarded by the little tribe of Israel. And maybe Jethro just happened to lead Moses out there one day. There's also a theory that takes us even further that the God of the Bible originally came from the Midianites around Sinai, later gaining Canaanite aspects, kind of instead of the other way around. There's really no way to know, and that's not exactly a universally accepted theory. To me, it is very simple, though, to accept that within the story, Jethro spent some time as the last semi-believer tending the diminished fire of God until Moses showed up to take the torch. It's like this. Moses, this whiny boy from the desert who wants to have a big adventure, who runs off out in the middle of nowhere, he winds up in the hills where a weird old guy tells him about a forgotten religion. That's right. Moses is Luke Skywalker and Uncle Jethro is Obi-Wan Kenobi. And God on the fire bush, of course, God is Yoda.
Of course.
The guy who says, like, great powers you will have.
Yes.
The Bible book that I most wish we had is the book of Jethro discovering God stuck on Mount Sinai. What is God saying to him? Maybe the story like of God getting stuck there in the first place. God just sitting there like Gollum. It's like swearing, you know, one day his precious people will return. So anyway, God has chosen Moses because he was the only Israelite who was ever going to stumble out there to the middle of nowhere. Exodus 4:24.
Things get really weird again. I had to read this so many times. So many times. Not that I wanted to, but I still can't wrap my head around it.
Theologians and scholars consider this one of the most confusing books in the entire Bible. No one knows what it means. So most confusing books in the Bible, you can find like 10 pretty good arguments or like there's this deeply forgotten historical context that makes it make sense. This one, you find scholars just throwing up their hands. So what happens is God and Moses and Zipporah and their kid are heading down to Egypt when God sees Moses is uncircumcised. So God tries to kill Moses.
After he's already told him to go to Pharaoh. So obviously God did not select Moses previously.
Also, God obviously did not like roll up Moses's robe.
He didn't Google him first.
It's just interesting that the journey starts and then.
Right.
So the best explanation I've seen is from Jack Miles, author of God the Biography. Miles spends all of his telling of Genesis on how God is obsessed with controlling human reproduction. If we say that is what the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is about, is reproduction, which makes sense considering they're talked about as naked and then immediately talked about as clothed. God is obsessed with reproduction during Noah's time. It's one of the two reasons given for the flood. God is obsessed with controlling the birth canals of Sarah and Rachel and Rebecca.
He's very much a be fruitful and multiply. But oh, no, not like that.
Be fruitful and multiply.
In the way that I want you
exactly
to.
Exactly as regulated. And like regulated, I feel like it's a good word. Circumcision. One explanation for it is that it is an acknowledgement that God controls creation. This device that humans use to create more humans, it is an acknowledgement that it is ultimately not humanity's. It comes from God. It's like registering your firearm. So God sees this. He realizes he's going to have to make do with what he has available, which is an uncircumcised Egyptian traitor fugitive. So God tries to kill Moses. How is he unable to kill Moses?
Oh, Zipporah. Zipporah then circumcises her baby boy and then throws the foreskin on Moses' feet. I don't understand here if she's trying to trick God into thinking Moses has just been circumcised and it just fell off.
she lops off the baby's foreskin and she holds it in front of Moses' dick, and God is like, good enough.
Yeah, it's really weird. It's like, as long as Moses' lineage is circumcised, then okay, fine, we'll work with this.
God just sees blood there and he's like, sure.
So weird.
There are also a whole other translations of these verses where like the nouns and pronouns are all mixed up. Maybe the uncircumcised person isn't even Moses anyway. Maybe it's the son. Maybe it's some whole other son. Maybe it's the Pharaoh himself that God is super mad that he's not circumcised. It's whatever, man. None of this changes the fact that what Zipporah does is the thing that works,
it's
right?
Bizarre.
Like, so basically, whatever it is that has so enraged God, Zipporah found the solution.
Right, as the women usually do. I mean, it does make sense, though, that Moses wasn't circumcised because he was raised Egyptian.
Yeah, why would he have been circumcised? His parents were Levites, an extremely important tribe, and we will see they are very zealous, but they'd been in Egypt for 400 years. Had this tradition carried on?
Well, also, the midwives were meant to kill the child, so they didn't really have time to circumcise him. Well, and then the Pharaoh also would have known for certain that this was a Hebrew child.
Well, I assume as the documentary Prince of Egypt by DreamWorks shows, Moses and Ramesses were essentially brothers as kids, which I think is a very smart move by the film. You know, they would have seen each other in the locker room. They show in the cartoon they're shirtless all the time.
Right.
Yeah, I think Ramesses would have noticed and he probably would have commented on it.
That could have ruined everything.
If Moses had been literally exposed, that could have really wrecked
the
whole
thing. If he had been circumcised, Moses wouldn't be who he is.
So maybe Moses could have just said like, hey, God, I was undercover the entire time. And so was my dong.
Oh, gosh.
Get it?
We all get it.
Perfect biblical commentary. So we're going down to Egypt. Now that the dick situation has been handled, God's like off the scent. We're going to go down to Egypt. We're going to talk to the Pharaoh.
Was Moses ever circumcised, though, even after this point?
I don't.
Because now I'm curious. All this circumcision talk.
It doesn't say that he is circumcised, but not only does this happen, he is also the one who passes on circumcision laws in Leviticus. So like, it's this weird thing where maybe God just said, all right, you do all this stuff and you don't have to do that. I don't know, man.
Or maybe it just happened and it was uneventful at that point. It is interesting, the stories of circumcision that they choose to share with us, though.
Yeah, they usually share it when it's like in mass, when it's like dozens of people have to do it, or when God is about to like eat his own number one prophet. Basically, it's only noteworthy when something horrible happens. I guess that's kind of how circumcision works these days, right? It's only really noteworthy when something horrible happens. So anyway, we're going to go see the Pharaoh. Which Pharaoh was this?
That's a good question.
So the most common answer is that it is Ramesses II, Ramesses the Great, from the 1200s BC. Most popular guess at who the main pharaoh is that we're going to meet. There are some Egyptian records of Ramesses complaining about conquered people making trouble. It kind of lines up. But you can also find plausible arguments for like a half a dozen other pharaohs as far back as the 1500s BC, including some who really did reestablish Egyptian control over Canaan. Isaac Asimov has a pharaoh theory. Sure. He argued for Ramesses' successor, Merneptah, based on Merneptah having a short and troubled reign.
That sounds very Georgia.
But that would mean Moses spent the really long reign of Ramesses just sitting around a campfire in Midian for decades and decades. Basically, it was either Ramesses or it was somebody right around his time zone, or it's just an amalgamation of all the Ramesses adjacent pharaohs, whatever. All right, so Moses and his spokesperson, brother Aaron, are gonna go tell the Pharaoh what time it is. It is time to let the Israelites go. For the third time, the Israelites managed to teleport directly into Pharaoh's throne room after Sarah and Joseph pulled this off. At this time, it makes sense because Moses, like, he would have a key or something.
Or he knew how to get in at the very least.
Yes, he knew the secret passcodes. And they go to Pharaoh and they say, hey, you gotta let your millions and millions of enslaved people go to Mount Sinai for a religious festival. This is new. When have the Israelites ever talked about Mount Sinai, about festivals on Sinai? Moses just learned for the first time about about this Sinai God to begin with. So we could speculate that God said, hey, I'm literally stuck here. You need to bring them here so I can reacquaint with them. It's also cool that Mount Sinai, which was not really mentioned in Genesis, is suddenly Asgard. This is a developing religion that is adding important places. It's cool to watch. But this is Pharaoh 3, and Pharaoh 3 is even meaner than Pharaoh 2. This Pharaoh says, I have never heard of this God of yours, and Egypt has tons of gods, so this God of yours must be nobody. In the Quran, it is clearer and it is a better representation of Egypt's actual religion, because in that book, Pharaoh basically says, you don't worship any god but me. And it's a pretty crucial detail that the Pharaoh in Egypt is essentially a demigod. So Pharaoh says, Moses, my former cartoon brother, just for this, the Israelites now have to make the same number of bricks, but without any straw. They have to spend all their extra time scrounging in the dirt, and they beat them for not producing it. Like, things are getting really horrible.
And they already had, you know, so much extra time.
The Israelites complained to Moses and Aaron. Look what you did. Moses and Aaron complained to God. Look what you did. And God says, got them right where we want them, boys. God tells Moses and Aaron, we're going to try it again, and this time we're not asking for a holiday to Sinai. We are asking for complete liberation. Moses is like, okay, this is going to go even worse. You don't understand. And God repeats the plan. I am going to obliterate the Pharaoh. I'm going to make him beg for more until I finally choose to stop. If this sounds like cruelty, first, let's remember the Pharaoh is horrible. And secondly, Exodus 7:5, here's the reason. The Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. Leave no doubt, run up the score. I like the detail that Moses is 80 years old, because I think it answers why we know he knows combat. We know he has combat moves. Why can't he just walk up and kill the Pharaoh like he did with that other Egyptian? Well, Moses is 80, so you can't expect too much ninjutsu out of him. So Moses and Aaron are like, fine. They go back to see the Pharaoh again, and this time they break out the snake trick, and the Egyptian wizards do it too, and they have two snakes. But then what happens? Aaron's snake eats all their snakes.
Yeah, that part is kind of metal.
Just like Joseph with the Egyptian dream interpreters, none of the Egyptian wizards can out-wizard our heroes. And Pharaoh doesn't care. God says, Pharaoh's heart is hardened. Passive voice, as if God doesn't know how this happened. Big guy, you have said twice that you are the one who will harden his heart. God just wants to put on a show. God just wants more magic tricks.
Yeah, he really wants to rub it in.
Yes. Aaron does the water blood trick, turning the entire Nile River into blood.
That's pretty gross.
So it kills fish, dehydrates humans.
Yeah, can you imagine the smell?
Pharaoh doesn't care about this because his wizards can also do the water blood trick. Genius. Now you have even more blood water.
Woohoo.
The blood Nile persists for at least a week. So imagine how many people have already died. This was the first plague, by the way, the very famous plagues. There's quite possibly some real history to some of these things. The Nile running red, for example, could be red algae from a specific lake. It could be red soil runoff from Ethiopia. So we're going to go through the plagues. And first, I want to introduce a somewhat of a theory that is, I think is totally supported by the text. And no one will ever be able to prove me wrong because we don't have the rough drafts. Emily, are you familiar with the Mega Man video games?
No, not at all.
So you are this little blue robot and you run around shooting little, it's like a Mario game kind of, but you have this little pew pew, you shoot this little gun out of your arm. And each level is like named after a different kind of boss who has like a power. There's like a fireman and like a blade man and a leaf man. But each time you defeat one of these bosses, you gain their power. So what God is doing with these plagues and why he keeps forcing Pharaoh to go through it again is God is taking on an entire pantheon full of bosses one by one, beating them at their own game, stealing their power, rebuilding himself, and annihilating a full pantheon of rivals.
It's like a transformer that keeps adding parts, like keeps adding new things.
Yeah, like constantly bolting on upgrades.
Right.
So this Nile plague, obviously Egypt has lots of gods associated with rivers, with the Nile specifically, with harvest. This is a humiliation of all these gods all at once. Right around this chapter, God says, on all the gods of Egypt, I will execute judgment. I am the Lord. This is a declaration of God war. So, plague two, God man versus frog man.
Oh boy.
There are frogs everywhere, even in, quote, beds and ovens. Again, the smell.
Yeah.
Also, again, the Egyptian magicians fail to think ahead about what will happen if they attempt to replicate the plague, because now they have bonus frog plague.
So many frogs. Can you imagine them being in your bed? Like,
oh. In your oven.
Yeah, well, your oven, like, they didn't have, like, oven doors back then, so they're probably just, like, giant kiln-type things.
If they forget to turn the kiln off when they leave the house.
Then they have frog legs for dinner.
You might think, what does this have to do with Egypt's pantheon? Well, the only time frogs are mentioned in the entire Bible as actual frogs and not just, like, spirits that look like frogs are during this plague, because Egypt has a frog god. And now that frog god humbled. Frogs are also a symbol of the flooding of the Nile, a crucial annual event for the economy and lifeblood of Egypt. So God is saying, your Nile flooding frog god cannot spam as many frogs as I can. So one sort of semi-explicit hint that there was supposed to be a god battle going on in these plagues that was deleted by some nerdy editor who was worried about acknowledging this monotheism isn't the world's only religion or something boring, is the Egyptian wizards who keep trying to keep up and keep are able to do magic stuff, are able to do supernatural stuff outside of the laws of the universe, they're just not as good at it, right? In some early version of the story, surely there was a god here instead of wizards, and this god was able to do some of the stuff our capital G god was, but capital G is just better at it. These wizards are losing, they're losing on their home court. Also, going back to Genesis 1, remember, we do know for a fact that there is weird, mystical, supernatural stuff that was deleted at some point from the Bible, as people decided it was supposed to be a monotheism. The ocean chaos monster of Genesis 1. Maybe when that got cut, so did all these Egyptian gods. Plague 3, Aaron turns all the dust of Egypt into gnats. We're now in Macon, Georgia. Mouthfuls of gnats everywhere.
Just breathing sounds awful. I bet that they would all love masks.
Grit your teeth and you're crunching gnats between your teeth.
No, they don't really crunch. I feel like they just like fly around your nose hairs and bother you.
But that many of them, they will amass. I think it would be sort of like chewing gum in your mouth at all times.
It's like riding, like being on a motorcycle and the bugs are hitting you in the face, except every time you take a step, it's happening.
Except that happens if you're standing
still.
It's
so gross.
This one, even Egypt's magicians are impressed by the gnat storm.
Or maybe they're just like, no, we're definitely not going to add more gnats to this chaos.
They figured it out by now. But like Egypt's wizards, they basically tap out here. Plague 3. We got a long way to go. Ugh. Egypt's wizards are like, yeah, God did this one. Pharaoh's heart is hardened. Uh-oh.
Again.
Plague 4. Flies everywhere, except in Israel's territory of Goshen. Also by now, subplot. Moses has leveled up. Little brother Moses has gained the confidence to do the talking. Aaron hands the microphone. Pharaoh breaks again. Says, fine, do sacrifices to your God. Moses says, nope, you missed your chance on that one, pal. We want to walk to Mount Sinai, like we said. Pharaoh says, fine, do it. You can go. The flies leave, and then Pharaoh's heart hardens.
I wonder if Pharaoh is realizing that he's basically conceding to all of these things, and then nope. He gets stubborn all over again. I wonder if he ever thinks about that and why that's happening.
How much self-awareness do you have when God is telling your brain what to think?
Right.
In the Quran, we get a little bit of background here. We get Pharaoh's constantly arguing to his people that this is all just cheap magic, all a scam. It's all the liberal media is making up the counts of the gnats.
Masks won't protect you from the gnats and flies.
Gnats will just... Masks create gnats, I heard on...
Well, masks don't help because they can still go in your eyes.
Also, the Pharaoh says he's going to make a tower tall enough to go fight God. I think that's the best plan for any leader.
Maybe this is where the idea that like God is above us, like in heaven, comes from, because he's building a tower to go up to him.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's like a Tower of Babel kind of thing, except this is the Pharaoh's plan for how to deal with the flies. Honestly, if there are flies all over, I think going into the stratosphere is probably a good idea.
Yeah, probably.
Because they do not have little astronaut suits.
And they were probably afraid to go swim.
Plague 5, livestock pestilence, except in Goshen. Again, now we're at the point where we're hitting a lot of cattle. And yes, Egypt has a lot of cattle gods, so God is defeating Cowman.
Bullman.
Egypt's magicians at this point are like watching LeBron score 60 points. They're applauding themselves.
Well, they're like, sorry, Pharaoh. I mean, there's nothing we can do.
What do you want us to do here?
You don't want more of this.
Pharaoh knows not only are all his own livestock dead, but all the Israelite livestock are fine, and yet his heart is hardened.
Again.
Plague 6. Let's hear it for festering boils, folks. All right. On humans and animals, violence has escalated. It has escalated so far, even the magicians are under attack, which, if you're like me and you take the magicians as stand-ins for gods, that means Egypt's gods themselves are suffering boils.
They have human qualities here.
Yes.
In order to be able to suffer that.
Very much. As do Egypt's gods to begin with. Egypt's gods are very personified in Egypt's own art. There are like 6 different Egyptian cattle gods. They all have bugs and boils all over their bodies.
Well, and at this point too, it's saying that the animals all have boils, but the livestock is all dead, so it's got to be like the birds, and I'm sure that there are cats. You can't have Egypt without cats, right? So there's got to be all of these like pet-like creatures now running around with boils, which is really sad.
Also, once again, hard heart. And this one goes back to making it clear. God is the one mind-controlling Pharaoh here. My first reading of the plagues in forever, and I was like, wow, this is messed up. You know, this Pharaoh is like, this is hell. This is torture. This is mind control. And of course, yes, he's horrible. He deserves to suffer as he has made people suffer. You know, and you're also thinking about like, well, there are surely lots of innocent Egyptians who are being caught up here. It's like, well, you know, it's kind of like General Sherman through the Confederacy, like you got to make him quit somehow, right? But then once I came upon like the Mega Man, this is actually a God versus God story that got turned into a semi-boring God versus wizards thing. The hardened heart thing is just in there as an explanation for why it has to continue. Because if it's God versus a bunch of gods, nobody feels bad about gods getting killed. They should be tough enough to handle it. But God versus people feels a little lopsided. So you kind of have to make this story device. God is passing the blame onto Pharaoh himself by making the Pharaoh request to continue.
I mean, all of it is basically a way for God to set himself up to be the only God. So if he doesn't continue it on for very long, like you say, he only has one plague, then that's kind of forgettable.
Yes. And God has 2 goals here. 1 is to free his people. 2 is to humiliate Egypt for his own clout. God says this.
Well, and he can't free his people if he doesn't humiliate Pharaoh.
What if God just goes in and does the one big bad plague, the one that works? What if that's what we lead with? I don't know. Plague 7, Exodus 9:16. God says, Moses, go tell Pharaoh, I could have killed you by now, but this is why I've kept you alive, to show you my power and make my name resound throughout earth. Time for the biggest hailstorm in Egyptian history with bonus fire from heaven. The hail fire kills almost all of Egypt's plants. Pharaoh is broken again. I've sinned. The Lord is right. Make it stop. Please get the Israelites out of here. Moses doesn't believe him, and then is confirmed because God changes Pharaoh's mind so that Moses was right to not believe the Pharaoh.
Moses here, I guess, he's kind of like this person that's thinking, okay, it's going to get better. It's going to stop. It's going to get better. It's going to stop. God told me that this is all going to happen, so maybe this is it. And he's finally catching on to, okay, we're not done yet.
I mean, obviously, Moses' primary goal here is he wants to see his people free, and surely on some level, he wants the violence and the suffering to stop. And I just picture every time he goes to the Pharaoh, he's like, please don't make me go tell God that you're still not on board. There's got to be this look in the Pharaoh's eyes like, I really want to be on board, but I can't.
Right. And it's really weird too, because Moses here is speaking to basically family at this point when he's talking to the Pharaoh. He's just met God. He's having to do this whole mental gymnastics routine probably to just keep up with what's going on and not just cave. But his end goal is to set free these people that he now realizes are his people.
Yeah. What resilience by Moses, because, you know, he knows what the final plague is. He knows the final plague is children will die. And Moses is still agreeing to continue because the ultimate goal outweighs even that suffering. So, fire from heaven. This is a very interesting one in terms of God versus God battle. One of Egypt's storm/fire gods was the big bull volcano god Baal himself, who was a version of a proto-Semitic war god and a partial inspiration for the YHWH god of the Hebrews character himself. Baal worship traveled from Canaan to Egypt forever ago. This isn't just an Egyptian god being humiliated by plague number 7. This is God's hometown rival. And anyway, can rain volcano god Baal do hailfire? Because God can do hailfire. And we'll see another god battle like 9 books from now. It also involves raining fire to humiliate Baal. Plague 8. Exodus 10:1. I've hardened his heart, again, in order that I might show these signs and that you may tell your grandchildren how I made fools of the Egyptians. At this point, Pharaoh's council is begging him to let the Israelites go. So he negotiates. Moses and Aaron, the Israelite men can leave Egypt, but the women and children stay. Locusts!
Bugs just keep getting bigger.
I would love this story if there's not even a rebuttal. As soon as that's out of his mouth, it's just bugs everywhere. That's it. The only answer you deserve is bugs, dummy. Pharaoh breaks again, confesses sin again, but the Lord hardens his heart again.
And part of this whole time that this is happening, remember, God was basically trapped on Mount Sinai, or wherever we want to say that is, for 400 years. So his people have forgotten about him. So he's making darn sure that they're not going to forget about him for the next 400 years.
Yeah, this is God building himself back up.
And showing what he's capable of.
Winning the faith of these people one by one. Yeah, I'm on board with whoever did this. Don't
right.
do it to me.
Well, if you're one of these Israelites that's enslaved in Egypt, and you see this God coming in and protecting all of your people and ruining the lives of all the Egyptians who have been your slave masters all of this time, you're going to be like so on fire for this guy.
Yeah. Plague 9. In a Mega Man game, there are 8 main bosses. God has worked his way through the 8 regular bosses. Then there's a final boss. There's a Mega Man character called Dr. Light. He's usually a good guy. This time he's a bad guy because Egypt's top god is the sun god. How do you humiliate a sun god? You block out the sun for 3 days.
Take it away.
The Egyptians have no water, no food, and no light, while the Israelites in Goshen are doing just fine.
Fair and they have light.
Yeah,
so can they
awesome.
Not see? Can the Egyptians not see the light that the Israelites have?
They literally can't see the light.
So are they all blinded? I'm just confused about the mechanics of this.
I think this is one where like a schematic, like if you're standing right here and you're looking across the little stream mm-hmm. that separates, like
can see that
you
there
see
is
that
light.
They are lit up?
Right.
I would guess so, because God would want you to feel bad about it.
Right, because darkness seems like one of the lesser plagues as far as harshness is concerned. So
yes, and I think that is further evidence for God theory, because why would you save this for last after you've done hailfire and all the other horrible things? Why would you save, like, it's kind of dark for a few days if this isn't about humiliating the sun god himself?
Right.
Pharaoh says, fine, take all your people, but your cows got to stay. You've killed all ours, after all. Right, buddy? Little joke among friends. Moses is like, you idiot. Our God loves meat.
Yeah,
he does. We're going to bring all our meat.
He really does.
Hard heart. And Pharaoh says, if we ever meet again, I'll kill you. And Moses is like, cool, we'll never see each other again anyway. It's a very, reading that verse is like, oh man, that's it. But then they're like, right, 5 verses later, they're talking to each other again. And plague 10, God says, this is it. Last one, big one. I forced Pharaoh to go through 9 rounds of this just to escalate to this one. Moses warns Pharaoh at midnight, God's going to kill every Egyptian firstborn from your family to the enslaved Egyptians, not the enslaved Israelites, to the animals God hasn't already killed. Exodus 11:9, God says Pharaoh won't listen in order that my wonders may be multiplied. Moses promised child sacrifice, but the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart one more time. What happened to our Abraham God who didn't like child sacrifice?
Yeah.
We got to relearn that lesson. But it's ultimately, this is
the only lesson Pharaoh will learn?
This is the harshest lesson possible and the harshest revenge possible. You got to keep reminding yourself, Pharaoh really sucks. Pharaoh is a really horrible person. And I guess just try not to think about the innocent life. Speaking of Abraham, remember when he and Sarah got stuck in Pharaoh's control and God had to do plague wonders to get them out of Egypt? The Bible is like this series of resounding echoes that like come and go and crash into each other.
It's like Egypt is God's biggest enemy throughout the Bible so far.
Plague 10. We have defeated all 8 Mega Man villains. We have defeated Dr. Light. And now God defeats Baby Man. Plague 10. Pantheon demolished. Now prevent it from rebuilding. The Pharaoh's son is destined to become an Egyptian demigod. And God doesn't just plan to kill the next god. God plans to kill him while he's still a human. And God's not done. More will happen. We will talk about that the next episode. We will go into a lot more detail on the actual night of Passover. And we will learn a whole lot more about what that really means to people in the modern world. So by the end, God has tore his way through the entire Egyptian pantheon through what our religious scholar friend Mike Altman called these mascots, these Egyptian mascots, these gods, humiliated them, put himself over at their expense, and is in the process of liberating these people. And like, even if you say, like, you know, I'm wrong about like this actually being the story of a god battle and like what we have here is what the story was supposed to be all along, still, he is humiliating an entire rival pantheon. pantheon and one of the most powerful. So many missions accomplished. Should we talk about Prince of Egypt now?
Yeah, let's do it.
Did you like this movie?
I did like this movie.
I had never seen it. I liked it. I thought Moses' conflicts were very well portrayed. A man with two identities, struggling with both of them.
He is a teenager for like the entire movie, though.
Yeah, he does come across as very, very young. But and like Moses with the Ten Commandments without the big gray beard, it just feels so off. But like,
and they don't talk about that part, but he's literally standing there at the end holding the commandments and you see him looking the exact same.
So the beginning when he is floating down the Nile, it's very exciting because there's like hippos and alligators fighting each other, and I think the Bible could have been improved by incorporating those details.
Yeah, I mean, they're like fighting each other off to save this boy.
I think they did a good job of Moses coming to terms with sort of survivor's guilt, wondering why the Israelites would listen to the Prince of Egypt. They show him bearing the burden of forecasting the plagues. Like, you really see him wrestling with what he is conveying. There's increased Zipporah Jethro content, which I of course appreciate as a big Jethro fan. However, Moses is played by Val Kilmer, and they do not let Val Kilmer sing. Val Kilmer tags in a Val Kilmer sound-alike.
Well, the cast in general has some issues because they're all a bunch of white people overall.
Yeah.
So, it's like Michelle Pfeiffer, Sandra Bullock. Yeah. I mean, it's really white.
The cast is incredibly star-studded.
Like, yes.
It's a ridiculous cast. And it's all these stars are like, you know, right around their peak. Like Val Kilmer had just been
and
Batman.
And Michelle
like,
Pfeiffer, too. She was
Val
very
Kilmer
big
had
at
just
that point.
Been Tombstone. Jeff Goldblum is in it as Aaron. And like, he kind of does nothing. But he should have been Moses. He would have been an awesome Moses.
And it was just wonderful that he was Aaron, at least. At least he was someone in it because it brings us back to our Jeff
Goldblum. Like,
Jeff Goldblum
would have been perfect because like, all right, now Moses is being at least being played by a Jewish person. Moses is being played by your actor most capable of delivering these nuances and these words. Like,
because
Jeff Goldblum's voice is like, all right, this guy has a lot in his mind.
He's always in conflict with himself when he's speaking. So, like, you can hear the confusion in his voice all the time.
Also, Jeff Goldblum. So Val Kilmer did voice God in this because the creators, they didn't, you know, you can't really compete with the big booming God voice that you hear in all these other movies. So they tried this cool thing where the voice of God that you hear is your own voice. You are created in God's image. How does God speak to you? Inside your own head, right? So Val Kilmer's the voice of God. If Jeff Goldblum gives us Jeff Goldblum.
That would have been wonderful. They did have Danny Glover.
Danny Glover is Uncle Jethro, which is appropriate as we know ethnically.
Yeah. He just didn't have very many lines.
He didn't have any. He had more lines than the Bible and a song, so.
But he didn't sing.
Jethro Hive, we are taking what we can get. Yeah, aside from the cat, I thought it had a few too many songs. There's like two main songs. There's a Deliver Us one, and then there's the one that with Mariah Carey, and I didn't find any of the other super memorable.
No, but the music isn't bad, and I think when DreamWorks created this, it was like they were really trying to up their game against Disney, so they really went all out as far as trying with the music and the cast.
It's hilarious that this was their second movie after Ants with a Z, the A Bug's Life
like, competitor,
preemptive ripoff, like the deep impact to A Bug's Life's
movie.
Armageddon. I didn't see Ants.
I did.
How does Ants compare to this?
Well, it was different, but I remember seeing it in the theater with my little brother and sister at the time because I was a really good big sister, and it was like a war movie with ants, from what I remember.
Well, yeah,
that's about all I remember.
Did you see this and think like, wow, they will probably very soon attempt the most ambitious animated movie in history to this point?
Obviously.
The look is very cool. The visuals are very cool. The animation doesn't feel dated at all just because it's so stylistic, tasteful with the computer animation. Awesome. The Red Sea looks very cool. And it seems well-researched visually, architecturally. Like, if you look up online what Egypt scholars have to say about the movie, they say it all looks cool. But, like, the difficult, awkward thing about an Egypt-Israel story is Egypt is still real. Egypt is still a real nation. So if you want to show Egypt as these monstrous supervillains, then you...
They're taking it personally.
Yeah. Hard to blame them. You know, like, this movie was banned in Egypt for a few reasons. One, for portraying Moses, who is a prophet in Islam. And secondly, for implying that enslaved Israelites built all of Egypt's wonders. And, like, as we now know, there was less enslaved labor going toward the pyramids and those other wonders than people have usually assumed. So, like, you know, in Egypt, they took this movie as offensive. You can say bad stuff about the Amalekites and the Edomites and the Hittites, but when you start talking about nations that still exist to this day,
it's a little different.
Things are awkward.
The movie does do some kind of neat things to answer questions of why things happened in history, like how the Sphinx's nose fell off.
Yeah, they sure. Roughhousing. Rowdy boys riled up in the name of the Lord.
Oh, and just like Moses being brothers with the Pharaoh and being raised as his brother, and they just have like the sibling rivalry going on throughout the entire thing.
Yeah, and Moses having a terrible wig that he loses. Actually, one detail that like it's kind of a subtle thing is Moses' skin tone. It starts the movie, he looks just like Ramesses because they're outside all day not wearing shirts. They have matching tans. Moses moves north, starts wearing robes all the time as a shepherd. When he comes back, his skin looks like the Hebrews. He has lost a little bit of suntan, and now he has more of an olive complexion. It's a pretty subtle thing that I think communicates a lot. So I'll say this movie was pretty good. One of the best Bible movies I've seen. As long as you say...
It's not perfect.
Let's do a better cast next time. One thing I plan to say in a later episode, but might as well say now, the story of Moses leading the Exodus has inspired oppressed people for thousands of years, including Black Americans and South Americans battling white supremacist colonizers, enslavers, and politicians. Liberation theology, a belief system that emphasizes social responsibility toward the poor and oppressed, finds some of its greatest inspiration in the story of the Exodus, along with the Torah's repeated commandments to defend orphans, widows, and refugees. Those who add in the Christian Testament find Jesus right at home in this worldview, a man who stands with poor people and women and is murdered by the Roman Empire for it. There's a lot of stuff in the Exodus story worth laughing at and marveling at, but the most valuable takeaway is this. This image of God is a God who stands with the powerless against the powerful.